And then we'll call to order the House
Committee on Rules for Monday, April 8, 2013. Our first order of business will be to open a public hearing on House Resolution 3 and call Representative Gelser forward, please. Ms. Seiler.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, H.R. 3 is in memory of Barbara Sackett, 1932 to 2012.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Garrett, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser, State Representative from House District 16, which is Corvallis and Philomath. Thank you for scheduling a hearing on House Resolution 3. If this meets with your approval today, it will be on the House floor on Friday, which is when Barbara's family is planning to be here. Barbara, I like to think of her when I go through the rotunda in the Capitol. She is the great-great-great-granddaughter of Eliza Spaulding, who is depicted on the mural right on the inside. Barbara was a phenomenal woman that we lost last fall. She was busy doing many things, raising eight children when her, I guess she was raising seven children, when her eighth daughter was born in 1956 with Down syndrome. She was urged to put her daughter at the Fairview Training Center, and she said no thank you, and raised her daughter at home with absolutely no support. And in the process of doing that, basically built what is today's developmental disability system. She became the first county developmental disability employee, the first state developmental disability employee, and she wrote the grant for what is now our brokerage system of supports, worked for the Department of Human Services, and helped to close Fairview. Phenomenal woman. I'll look forward to telling you more about her on Friday. If this meets with your approval, happy to answer any questions.
We have the votes. We'll be happy to move it. Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you, Representative. Oh, sorry. Yes.
What year was that when you said she started writing the brokerage system? How far back does that go, Representative?
Well, Chair Garrett, Representative Berger, Leanne was born in 1956. I think she became a paid worker in the 1970s, but she started with advocating for her daughter to be allowed to go to preschool. When she was born, she was not allowed to enroll in public school. Barbara actually led the passage of legislation in the Oregon legislature that allowed children with Down syndrome into public schools that predated the federal law. So Barbara really opened up public schools, housing, and work for people with developmental disabilities, and went on to do a lot around affordable housing as well for all low-income people. Extraordinary woman.
Thank you. Any further comments? Thank you. Do we have any other testimony on this? All right, well, we'll just get this done. We'll close the public hearing on House Resolution 3, open a work session on House Resolution 3.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move House Resolution 3. Is this okay?
Yes.
To the floor with a do adopt recommendation.
Representative Berger moves H.R. 3 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Motion carries. H.R. 3 is adopted. Representative Gelser, carry the bill, please.
Yes, please.
Thank you very much. We'll look forward to hearing more about it. Now we'll open a public hearing on H.C.R. 28. Representative Clem?
Can I come?
Oh, I'm sorry, and Berger, too.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, H.C.R. 28 designates September 5th, 2014, as Saxon Day to recognize South Salem High School's tradition of excellence.
In either order.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from here in District 21. As you will probably come to learn, I am not an alumni of Saxonville, but somebody is. She's very excited about this, and I think that's pretty cool myself. So I won't go through all the details of all the various accomplishments, including 19 state championships, an incredible culinary program. See, I'm starting to go through them right now. I will save that for a floor speech and just ask you to keep in mind one exciting thing. This resolution is really designed to educate a class of students about the lawmaking process. So you'll hear from them in a moment, but that's a lot of why, beyond honoring South Salem, we're doing this resolution, is so they can learn what it's like to lobby, what the rules committee is, what it's like to make prepared remarks for a legislator and understand exactly how a bill becomes a law. So that's part of the educational process that we are advancing, along with making September 5th, 2014 Saxon Day, if you are so inclined. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Berger, State Representative, District 20, and that we know of, the only graduate of South Salem High School who is currently in the body as an elected official. I'm very proud of my high school, of its accomplishments. It's been a school with a great tradition of excellence and of reaching out. It was one of the early IB schools in the state. There have been a number of firsts around the Saxons, and they have a great staff of educators who believe in hands-on learning, and this is a case in point. History teacher who's gone above and beyond to bring the students down here to be part of this process. You're going to hear from them in a minute. I just want you to understand that we are all proud of the schools in our state and our individual schools, but today is my special day to be particularly proud of the Saxons and what they represent. And as the graduate of 1967 class,
we're going to ask you what year.
Oh, well, it's okay. I was a mere child at the time.
Mm-hmm. I can tell you
your
age.
Yeah. It was a three-year school at the time. It was one of the, in the era of enormous high schools before they opened other schools in the city, and I was one of a huge number who plied the halls in a three-year high school, but got a good education there and with a really proud tradition that we were aware of then. We were Saxons and we knew it. So thank you. And I know you'll be interested in our students and what they've accomplished.
Thank of course. You. All right. Thank you both. So we have two witnesses here on this, Jasmine Cruz and Karina Gonzalez. Come on up. Thanks for coming.
Chairman Garrett and members of the committee, my name is Karina Gonzalez. I'm a junior at South Salem High School. South Salem High School is an impeccable school approaching 60 years of excellence. We are here to ask for your support to pass a resolution commending South's excellent history and accomplishment. Through this project, our American government class is learning about the legislative process, and we hope to instill South Saxon Day on September 5th, 2014. We appreciate you hearing HCR 28 and are asking that you and your committee support the resolution. South has one of the best and unique academic programs in Salem, Oregon. It is one of 19 high schools in Oregon with the International Baccalaureate Program and the only one in South Salem. It was first introduced in 1999 and has been consistently growing. 53% of the juniors and seniors at South are involved in IB classes. South Salem High School is one of the first schools in Oregon to start the Academic Honors Program in 1983, and the Honors Program has been at South High since 1955. In 1987, South Salem High School was honored as a Blue Ribbon School, which is one of the highest honors bestowed to a school in the United States. South Salem High School strives and attains academic excellence. Through 60 years, South Salem High School has always competed at the highest levels that the state has to offer in athletics. Overall, South has won 19 state championships in 11 different sports. Additionally, South Salem has a tradition of having the best athletic program in the Central Valley Conference. They have won 14 director's trophies in 33 years of the award being in progress. South Salem is also the only school in the history of Oregon to win football and tennis state championships in the first year of the school being open. All of these accolades are examples of South's excellence in athletics. Another strong point at South Salem High School is the DECA chapter. South Salem High School has a strong DECA program that builds leaders and entrepreneurs. It gives students business experience, promotes innovation, teamwork, professional responsibility, leadership, and community orientation. Approximately 150 students are involved at South, and these students receive knowledge directly applicable to careers and professional interactions, which benefits them in their futures. Since 2006, South Salem High School has sent 177 students to the International Career Development Conference. In 2012, South had 12 students placed as finalists, being the top 16 in the world. Out of all of the prizes awarded at the State Career Development Conference, South Salem High School wins approximately 3/4 of the awards. South's DECA chapter is the paragon of DECA excellence in Oregon. So my classmate Jasmine will now share with you more of the accomplishments.
Hello, Chair Garrett and members of the committee. My name is Jasmine Cruz. I am a junior at South Salem High School. I would like to thank you for the opportunity for allowing me to testify today. And I'm glad to share with this committee the accomplishments of our culinary program, music program, tradition, and history. Our culinary program is unique, award-winning, and inspiring. Many South Salem High School students reach out to the culinary program because the culinary teacher is a former chef. He teaches the students to obtain skills that are not available anywhere else in Salem. He allows them to experience and deal with the pressure of being a chef. Our culinary team are very well trained. They competed at the national competition 5 times and won Oregon Pro Start High School Culinary Championship. After all the hard work and commitment these students put into the culinary program, they are awarded with scholarships to pursue their career. South Salem High School's music program has outstanding accomplishments. It's one of the best examples of our school's history of excellence. South Salem's orchestra and jazz choir are two of the best in the state. Our school has been honored with a Golden Plated Music Program and has won 32 state championships. South Salem High School has won 2 Grammy Awards and is a Grammy Signature School Gold recipient. Our history and tradition at our school have been full of excellence. South Salem High School has various accomplishments, which have led to successful graduates whom have profoundly profited in the community. Each student has benefited from something that the school offers, and would like to see a day implemented to commend the school for its excellence. Thank you for your time and consideration. We ask that you adopt HCR 28, and we are happy to answer any questions you may have for us. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I'd, for the record, I'd like to comment that I wasn't in music. I can't cook. I wasn't in DECA. So I fit in that last category that I'm glad she mentioned, that those of us who were there benefited greatly for the education and may not have distinguished themselves at that time, but I'm here and I'm very proud of it.
Well, as usual, the people who can't do anything else wind up in elective office.
There you go, Mr. Chair. And I really thank the students for highlighting all of the great accomplishments of the students and the school itself. So with that, Mr. Chair, I move HCA.
We haven't opened yet.
Nope.
Any other questions? Right. Thank you. Thank you both for taking time to be here and for sharing the school's accomplishments. Close the public hearing on HCR 28. Open a work session on HCR 28. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move HCR 28 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Representative Berger moves HCR 28 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, motion carries. HCR 28 is moved to the floor. Representative Berger, Representative Clem, co-carry.
Better letters, you'll have my eye.
Okay. Close the work session on HCR 28. Since they both just walked in, we'll open a public hearing on HB 3023. Ask Representatives Richardson and Bailey to come forward. Ms. Seiler.
And members, House Bill 3023 expands mission of Fusion Sister State Committee to allow for organization of visits, exchange of information, work on joint projects, and promote economic development with all provinces of People's Republic of China, changes the name of the Sister State Committee to Oregon China Sister State Committee to reflect expanded mission. There is a no revenue impact. We did receive a no fiscal impact right before the committee.
And our resident China scholars, Representatives Bailey and Richardson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dennis Richardson. I represent District 4, which is Southern Oregon, Western Jackson County to Eastern Josephine County. And for the last 10 years, I've been involved with the trade missions that Oregon has sent with legislators and business individuals that have gone to China. It started off primarily as part of our ongoing sister state relationship that Oregon has with the Chinese province of Fujian. At the time that we started, and we take no credit for this, but the time that we started, our exports to China were 15th, and now, just before the recession, they had gone to number one and were about $4 billion a year. Now it's between Canada and China. But anyway, so it's been very positive, very productive for us to do this. But in the course of what we've done, we've gone beyond just dealing with Fujian province. And there are the various provinces, and then there's also 5 cities that have provincial status, one of which is Tianjin, which is a 7 million person population city that's connected just to the east of Beijing by bullet train. And they have expressed an interest of also becoming part of a relationship with Oregon. And they have already shown that that would be very profitable for all of us involved. The Chinese find that when they're respected and shown honor, that they want to reciprocate. And so the holdback was that our committee is called the Oregon Fujian Sister State Committee. And this basically says Oregon-China Sister State Committee, and then changes a couple definitions so that we can expand beyond Fujian. We've talked with Fujian. They said, we understand, not a problem. It doesn't hurt our feelings. We have another state or two that we're sister states with, and so there is no resistance to this, and it would really help if we could make this change.
Thank you.
I think, for the record, Jules Bailey has District 42. I think my good colleague, Representative Richardson, has summed it up well, and I would just simply add that I think this has been an excellent relationship. Both sides have seen positive economic outcomes from it, and I hope it can move forward with this simple fix. Thank you.
Senator.
Chris Edwards, State Senator in Eugene and Junction City. I probably don't have anything of substance to add, so I would say ditto, and I think the current status is a bit limiting in opportunity for Oregon as we try to build our state's relevance and presence in China. And I think this is a good change that would help facilitate growth of that relationship.
Okay. Representative Berger.
Just a comment, if you wouldn't mind, Mr. Chair. Representative Richardson, I have watched this relationship grow. Been just so impressed the way you have carefully and with great sensitivity started with just a small relationship and grown it into something hugely meaningful for our state, and you are to be personally congratulated for, and this expansion reflects what started as just a little tenuous link and how it has turned into just really an important series of relationships. Thank you for this effort, and thank you for this bill that speaks to how much it's grown.
Thank you. All right, seeing no additional questions, thank you to the panel.
Thank you.
No further testimony, so we're going to close the public hearing on HB 3023, and I will open a work session on HB 3023.
Mr. Chair, I move HB 3023 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hicks moves HB 3023 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? Hearing none, motion carries. HB 3023 is passed to the floor. I'll ask Representatives Bailey and Richardson to co-carry. Thank you. Close the work session on HB 3023, and open the House public hearing on House Bill 2597. Mr. Chief Justice, thank you for waiting. And I'll call Chief Justice Ballmer as well as Kevin Campbell, please.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2597 directs the Public Officials Compensation Commission to make recommendations on salaries of elected officials, including state senators and state representatives, requires governor to include recommendations in governor's budget report, directs legislative assembly to consider recommendations in adopting state budget, applies to salaries established for biennia beginning on or after July 1, 2015. There's a no revenue impact. We still have the fiscal impact is pending.
Chair Garrett, Vice Chair Hicks, members of the committee, I can let Mr. Campbell start with this. This is a bill that actually was proposed by...
I need your name for the record, Your Honor.
Tom Ballmer, Chief
Thank
Justice.
You.
Chair Garrett, I appreciate it.
I don't get to interrupt a judge very often.
So.
Yeah, I see your red light is on, Mr. Chairman. No, he was very generous. This bill, Chair Grant, members of the committee, was the idea of and is very important to the Circuit Judges. The Circuit Judges Association, represented by Mr. Campbell, will address it very briefly, but I have a personal interest in it too, and I'll speak second if that's okay with the committee.
So, Chair Garrett, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Circuit Court Judges Association, obviously to speak in favor of House Bill 2597. As you probably will remember, many of you, in 2007, the Oregon Legislature restructured and re-energized a public officials compensation commission. The legislature did that based on the recommendations of the Public Commission on the Oregon Legislature. And in 2008, the Public Official Compensation Commission actually released a report issuing recommendations to the governor, as was directed in statute, about what appropriate salary levels or compensation levels might be. It was done on a pretty detailed basis, and it was a commission that was largely independent because of its makeup. It was an 11-member commission, appointed and included a significant number of public members. And so for the first time, the commission had a unique, independent spirit about the recommendations. Not everybody loved the recommendations, but the fact that it was independent is helpful to the legislature and the governor because it gives them another perspective when making those decisions. At that time, the governor included those recommendations in their budget report, and then the legislature, of course, has the ability to decide whether they make sense or not based on budget realities or based on the recommendations and whether they agree with them. In 2009, the Public Officials Compensation Commission was changed. Its mission was changed. And the mission then was just simply to introduce a bill with recommendations. And since that time, the commission, to my knowledge, has not met. Reappointments have not occurred, and although there is a statute,
one has
been appointed recently, but largely many of the appointments have gone vacant. And so what you have now is a public official compensation commission that, while it has a charge in statute, it doesn't operate. And we believe that it makes sense to return it to its pre-2009 condition based on the recommendation, again, of that public commission on the Oregon legislature. It is an independent commission, so what this would do, again, would be to direct the commission to provide recommendations to the governor. The governor would then include it in the governor's budget report, and the legislature, again, as always, would be able to make decisions about what they're appropriate. The other piece of this legislation, which also restores it to pre-2009 legislation, is that it unlinks legislative and judicial compensation. In 2009, and I can't remember the reason for it, they were put together, and that's what creates kind of the odd language that you'll see right below Section 1, where legislative salary is either one step below the maximum of salary range 1 or 17% of a circuit court judge's salary. Of course, that's an odd language to begin with, but in addition to that, it means that when you're making a decision as a legislature about compensation, judicial compensation, you're in that very same decision having to consider your own compensation. Let me pause at this point to say, personally, I believe the legislators are not paid adequately. And so I believe that this is a difficult challenge that legislators face to make these decisions. But our conjecture is that if you can, House Bill 2597 unlinks those again, allows you to make those decisions independently, and really restores both of these items back to the pre-2009 reality. And so with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll turn it over to the Chief Justice for additional comments. Thank you.
Okay, good afternoon again, Chair Garrett, Vice Chairs Hicks and Hoyle, members of the committee. I'm Tom Ballmer. I'm Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. As I said, the Judicial Department didn't sponsor this bill, but I am here personally and on behalf of the court to support House Bill 2597. It's important to me because it addresses really two process issues. First, it uncouples the legislative salaries from judicial salaries, or judicial salaries from legislative salaries. In at least one state, this issue was actually litigated as a separation of powers issue. This linking of judicial and legislative salaries, and the New York Court of Appeals, which is that state's highest court, said it was a violation of separation of powers. Now, I haven't studied the New York Constitution. I have no idea what would happen if it was litigated here. But for Oregon, I think the uncoupling these salaries would make it easier for you to consider judicial compensation on its merits without having to think about declaring potential conflicts of your own or what it might mean for you personally or politically. These are two different salary issues that can be considered and probably should be considered separately. And second, this bill would restore the connection between the recommendation of the Public Officials Compensation Commission and the governor's recommended budget.
if you're going to ask the citizens of the state to devote a substantial amount of their time to studying public official compensation, I would submit, then their recommendations probably ought to be honored by at least being formally considered or put into the governor's budget or considered in some way. Of course, the legislature has the authority to decide whether to accept those or modify them or reject them altogether. I know this committee is not considering judicial compensation itself, but those of you who do serve on the House Judiciary Committee already have heard that Oregon state judges are among the lowest paid in the country. You've heard that in large counties, the judge may well be the lowest paid lawyer in the courtroom. And that's not just in civil cases where you have well-paid lawyers representing corporations or wealthy individuals, but also in criminal cases where the senior deputy district attorney and the defense lawyer may well be paid substantially more than the trial judge who's hearing the case. But most importantly to me, Oregon needs to have a bench with a diverse range of legal and life experiences among the judges. We need to have judges who are experienced in handling the sort of complex criminal and civil and family law matters that are heard every day in our courts. Our judges are very committed to their profession. Like you, they didn't take the job in order to get rich. But dedication to public service by itself simply will not allow us to attract and retain the diverse bench that Oregon needs. So I ask you to approve this bill and send it to the House floor. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? This is your chance to question the Chief Justice. Really? No questions? Representative Holmey. All right.
So, I appreciate the opportunity to ask a question, Mr. Chair. And I'm somewhat supportive of this notion because I feel that the legislature tied their salaries to other public officials in the trying to get rid of that conflict where we were deciding exactly what our salary would be. But I think as a result, we've done a disservice to the courts and have not really have basically held back their salaries because they're tied with our political dilemma of raising our own salaries. Would you care to comment on that?
Chair Garrett and Representative Holvey, I think you hit the proverbial nail on the head, actually. Thank you.
Representative Barnhart, did you have a question?
Well, yes, Mr. Chair, if I may. I've reviewed this bill, and it appears to me that the only thing of substance that it actually does is that decoupling. Is that your view as well?
Chair Garrett, Representative Barnhart, the other piece that it does change that's substantive in our mind is the current language or direction for the Public Official Compensation Commission is to now introduce a measure within the Oregon legislature. This would restore that communication back through the governor's recommended budget process. So that it is both that and that other piece.
I see that now. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And why is it that you would come before this August body and ask them to make a public confession of their minority status in the work world in our state?
Chair Garrett and Representative Jensen, I would like to defer to the Chief Justice.
Chair Garrett, Representative Jensen, I'm not sure I can address that question, but I will let me try and address it by making the point that what is more, one could argue that this it might be beneficial for the salaries to be linked because then we would benefit from the largesse of the members of the legislature in compensating themselves. I think that has not proved to be the case. I think we have been held back. But the important thing to me and the reason that I support this, even if you thought there would be some benefit to the courts and compensating the circuit judges appropriately is sort of my main concern, because I want to attract and keep good circuit court judges. They really ought to be considered separately. These things shouldn't be tied up. I think it's important for the legislature to be able to consider and evaluate and make decisions about these two issues separately. The artificial linkage just doesn't really make any sense, I don't think. And that's why I think splitting them makes sense. And then you can decide what you want to do on judicial compensation when we can have that discussion, and what you want to do on legislative compensation.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry to ask another question, but it's been a long time since I've paid any attention to the salary issues, and I simply don't remember whether there are constitutional limits in Oregon on the legislature's authority under what would be Section 3 of this bill, on page 3, which basically says that the elective officer should be paid an annual salary on a monthly basis as determined by the Legislative Assembly each biennium. I know there are limitations in the federal Constitution on what Congress can do for its own salary and what it can do for Article 3 judges, but I simply don't know what restrictions, if any, there are in the state Constitution around that issue.
You know, well, Chair Garrett, Representative Barnhart, to answer the question, there is in the Oregon Constitution, as there is in the federal Constitution, a prohibition on reducing the compensation of a judge while in office. And it is, it's sort of a nice question as to whether the whether you could, notwithstanding the link between judicial compensation and legislative compensation in current law, and even under this bill, sort of whether that would affect legislative compensation in some way. But to answer your question, you can't reduce the salary of a judge during their term of office. There's another nice legal question that I won't purport to try and answer about whether you could change them on a prospective basis so that once a judge's term ended, if they ran for another term, their new salary would be less, but you can't cut it during the term.
Thank you. And
yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a recollection that this odd connection that we're talking about was written the way it was because we were trying to make sure our own salaries didn't go up in an emergency, in a situation where we didn't want to raise them. And that could be completely wrong, but
that
I think that's...
That rings a bell.
I think that's what happened. And hence that funny percentage things of that sort.
Thank you. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for giving me one more opportunity to give you a shovel to start digging a little deeper to on the hole you start out. not being the intention of the questions, however. I truly am troubled by the salary that judges are paid in the state of Oregon. And sometimes when I look at the proceedings, it reinforces the old adage that you get what you pay for. But the same thing applies, Mr. Chairman, when it comes to legislators. No disrespect meant to any of the members of this committee, but you get what you paid for. I don't know how a society, and I got to have a question, I suppose, in here to keep from being gaveled down, so it wouldn't be the question. I don't know how a modern, contemporary, civilized, I think, society can expect to get top quality people to step up to the job for, you know, Circuit Court judges. I know a recent justice over in my district who probably gave up in excess of $250,000 a year practice to step onto the Circuit Court. Now, I'm delighted that he did this, quite frankly. I'm delighted that he did it because, you know, this is the type of people that I think we want in positions like that. And I think we would send our citizens a message by saying so. So, along the same lines, I think this is the type of people we'd like to have run for all public office, including legislators and kind of reminds me when I was teaching. It's a type of thing I would think as far as educators are concerned. When I saw students out of a two-year community college leaving school and going out into the job market and making almost twice what their professors were making. I think we've got our value system very confused here. I guess I might even go so far as to say it's kind of schizophrenic. And I wish there were some way that we could deal with this. Contrary to what Mr. Campbell may have thought, I'm going to support the bill today. Though I'm not really sure that we've gotten at the root of the problem with the bill. I'm not sure it doesn't take more courage than this bill demonstrates. I rationalize that we got to start someplace. And if this is a place to start, then I'm willing to make that step.
Thank you, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative. I certainly share your perspective. I also come at this from being a legislator, but also a practicing lawyer. And as Representative Hicks and I have seen in Judiciary Committee, this is just one way in which we are neglecting the judicial branch. And so I don't want to see our unwillingness to adequately fund the legislative branch be an impediment to funding the courts the way that we need to fund them. So I strongly support the bill. Appreciate you bringing it forward.
Thank you.
I think we've concluded our discussion of it. So thank you both very much.
Thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2597. I'll open a work session. No?
We do not have the paperwork.
Oh, my mistake. We're not quite ready to move it today. We'll wait for paperwork. So our next item of business will be should we just do 3405 while she's in? We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3405. Ms. Seiler.
And members of the committee, House Bill 3405 requires Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to create, upon request of member of the Legislative Assembly, racial and ethnic impact statement for proposed legislation or state measure. Requires that statement pertaining to the measure be printed in the voter's pamphlet. Requires state agencies awarding grants to include racial and ethnic impact statement in grant application. There is no revenue impact on this measure. A fiscal statement was issued. This measure does have a subsequent referral to Joint Committee on Ways and Means. In addition, a very similar bill, with the exception of the requirement that state agencies award grants, has moved out of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senate Bill 465, and is on its way to the Senate floor next week.
Thank you. Colleagues, we may end up using the Senate bill on this may ultimately be the vehicle that implements this legislation, but we do have someone, and neither of our legislative colleagues who are sponsors could be here today, but we have one person who has made the effort to come, so we're going to go ahead and have the hearing. Ms. Dollar?
The committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to this bill today. I'm here on behalf of, sorry, for the record, my name is Tiffany Dollar, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Student Association, and I also sit as the current student body president at Portland State University. The Oregon Student Association represents over 100,000 students across the state of Oregon, and our board of directors is made up of student body presidents from all of our member campuses. I wanted to come and talk to you today about this bill because our organization does have a focus on LGBT students and the needs of students of color as well, and we are dedicated to increasing affordability and access to post-secondary education for all Oregonians. We are in support of the House Bill 3405, and we really support this bill because if we hope to reach 40-40-20, we need to engage more students from underrepresented communities, including communities of color. Oregon's demographics are changing, and in order to keep this testimony brief, I'll just make an apples-to-apples sort of comparison and talk about how we see this affecting education. According to the 2000 census, there were a little bit more than 275,000 individuals in the state of Oregon who self-identified as Latino or Hispanic. That was about 8% of the population of Oregon at that time. In 2010, that number had grown to over 450,000, or about 11.7% of Oregon's population. That growth isn't exactly reflected at the university level. And the most, looking back at 2000, just to compare again with the previous census numbers, of these 69,000 students within the OUS, only 259 of those students identified as Latino, and that was only about 3% of OUS. And this year's fall class, there's over 100,000 students in OUS now, had 7,148 students who identified as Latinos, which is about 7%. So you can see that there's a disparity between our statewide population and who's making it to school. And so we know that depending on if your parents go to school, and there's a lot of other mitigating factors that have an impact on whether or not you pursue post-secondary education. We see these statistics as illustrating that post-secondary education policy hasn't been keeping up with Oregon's changing demographics. This is true statewide and especially within post-secondary education. If we were to have racial and ethnic impact statements related to education policy, we believe we'd be able to make better decisions to serve the students in these populations. And this bill isn't going to change our policies, but it will allow leaders like you to make educated choices. And we really can't afford to continue making uneducated decisions anymore. Oregon is changing, and we need to be relevant and include the facts in the decisions that we make so that we can all be a part of 40-40-20. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? No. We appreciate your testimony. Again, colleagues, we'll take this up again in the near future, either in this bill or the Senate bill if it comes over here. So for now, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3405. And our final agenda item is to open a public hearing on House Bill 3294. Representative Varnhart.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3294 exempts electronic mail addresses in possession or custody of executive department from required disclosure under public record laws, except for electronic mail addresses furnished by public body to public employees.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Phil Barnhart, State Representative from House District 11. This bill goes on and on for page after page after page after page, and the part you're looking for is on page 7, the last four lines. That's the only part that's germane to anything. This is the This is the statute that establishes items which are exempt from disclosure under the statutes in Chapter 192. And it adds electronic email addresses in the possession or custody of an agency or subdivision of the executive department, except, of course, for those email addresses that are furnished to public employees. So the email addresses of the director of the department and other would be exempt from this exemption statute. The point, I think, is illustrated by the fact that not terribly long ago, there was a major request for release of this public information, and some 480,000 email addresses were released, and they were addresses that had been given to various departments for very specific purposes, all kinds of different specific purposes having to do with the business of the department, and ones that I suspect the email address owners had no inkling that they might be subjected to email from persons who obtained these addresses for purposes other than the purpose for which they were furnished to the department. I personally received a missive from the Department of Transportation in which they warned me that this had happened and that I should be expecting to receive emails that at my personal email address that were not related to the department's business. This seems to me to be one of those times when if we really want to encourage people to use our internet connections for doing business with the state, allowing them to be secure in the knowledge that their email addresses are not going to be released so that people can use them for purposes other than the purpose for which they gave the email address to a state department. Countervails the point of having our internet systems in use. I have high hopes for Oregon's developing portal system for the development of doing business with the state by many individuals using online systems, and the extent to which the possibility that they may receive emails from people having purposes other than the ones related to the object of the release of information to the department, I think reduces the likelihood that people will use these kinds of systems. When we checked with the Department of Administrative Services, we discovered that there were at least a few complaints. Usually when there's a complaint about this kind of a release, you can expect that they would be reflecting of many, many other people who were annoyed but didn't know who to complain to or chose not to. And that's the substance of the bill.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
Yeah, Representative, I'm reading this and I'm still not sure. The target that you're trying to exempt from the public records is personal emails, not because it says doesn't apply to electronic mail addresses furnished by a public body to public employees.
Correct.
So if you are an employee of a public body, your email is part of the public record.
Yeah, your state.or.us email.
Or city of say
yeah, correct your CI.
State,
Eugene,
or right. any level of public service.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, this bill, as I understand it, applies to agencies or subdivisions of the executive department. I don't think that, and you've raised a very interesting point, because the bill doesn't actually apply to cities, counties, fire districts, library districts, et cetera, perhaps that would be a reasonable expansion of the bill. It only applies to executive departments of the state.
My point is simply that this may be far bigger than this simple language implies. You might have opened a huge can of worms here, Representative, but wouldn't be the first time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, no, it certainly would not be the first time, and you have suggested an amendment that we probably ought to consider.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I understand the desire to shield someone's personal email from a public disclosure. It mirrors my desire to shield your actual address from public disclosure under some other bills that we have heard before this body. Thank you.
Further comments, questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
So just to clarify, Rep. Barnhart, the exemption to the exemption would, that is for public employees, would only apply to their work emails. Is that correct? It wouldn't apply to their home emails, which the agency might have possession of.
Mr. Chair, Representative Member, that's correct. Under this language, the home email, the personal email of a state employee would be private. It would not be releasable. But the email furnished to them by the state agency would be releasable because it would be accepted from the exception.
Representative Hicks.
And do you know, are legislators considered public employees for purposes of this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, they are not included in the language of the bill because it applies only to agencies or subdivisions of the executive department.
Can I follow up on that?
Follow up.
I'm going just the last line. This subsection does not apply to electronic mail addresses furnished by a public body to public employees. So if a legislator were, for some reason, asking for this information, would the executive have to turn it over or not? It comes down to
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, the intent of the language was to describe the email addresses used by public employees for their official business. And the email of an executive department employee at state.or.us. I think your reading of the exception is.
Oh, now I'm following you. Okay.
Is actually one that I have made myself a dime or two, and you may have suggested another amendment to this to make it clear that we're talking about those specific email addresses, not the right of a public employee to then go looking for the private email addresses of other persons, which is, I think, the way this language is drafted, another way you could read that language. But that's not what we intended.
Thank you.
Guess we're making a lot of progress.
Mr. Chair, the two amendments have come up with two questions.
Anybody else have an amendment?
That's about par for the course.
None from me.
Representative Hoyle does not have an amendment to your bill.
Can we include the legislative branch?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have no other witnesses to testify on this bill, so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3294. I guess we'll wait and see what's going to happen on that one. We are finished with our business. Committee's adjourned.